you can either be right or be in a relationship.
I love that.
And he said, you can't cuddle up with being right at the end. We go through a lot of our lives, a lot of the time, unfortunately, in a very kind of unconscious, zombie-like state. And social media has made that 50 times worse. A third of the birds have gone. It may well be our children will never wake up and hear the dawn chorus, not many years away, where we'll be speaking to AI and listening to AI, and it'll sound like, you know, Jarvis in an Iron Man. It'll be a normal conversation. Most salespeople speak 65% of the time and listen 35%. If you want to close more often, you need to be listening 65%.
So could you tell us the power of pausing, giving lots of room, and actually silence and saying nothing?
Silence is your best friend in a sales conversation. And not be able to do it, that's going to lose so many sales.
Julian Treasure, thanks for being here.
Well, I'm excited to actually meet you guys physically, because
yes,
last time we did this, it was virtual.
Yes, it was. And it's a big honor. I'm excited to get into this. So we always start a podcast off the same way. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Well, I'm Julian Treasure. And for a long time, I've been solving the problem of bad sound for companies, but I don't do that anymore. I am now setting out to solve the problem of the world not listening.
Nice. Okay. And then let's test your qualifications if we can. If someone's listening to this and thinks, well, why is this guy qualified to tell me about this? What would you tell them?
I started about 20 years ago after a long career in marketing by setting up a company called The Sound Agency. And that involved doing a lot of research, because the question there was, how does your brand sound? And not many businesses think about that still, actually, even 20 years later. So a lot of research went into that. I then wrote a book called Sound Business, which was about how to use sound effectively in any kind of business, from the sound of your corporate reception to the sound of your telephone calls, which are normally pretty bad. Press one for this, press two for that. You know, older people hate that. And they don't give you queue times or opportunities to speak to real, you know, all that kind of stuff. Most organizations sound bad. And along the way, I had an epiphany, which was the reason most organizations sound bad is because they're full of people who are not listening. So I got to do some TED Talks. The first one, I think, was 2009, thereabouts. And actually, I then got to do four more in successive years, which is pretty unusual. And the last one went completely ballistic. So there was a lot of research behind all of these. The first one was about how sound affects us, the second about sound and health, the third about listening, the fourth about architects not designing for the ears and creating spaces that are not fit for purpose. And the fifth one, the one that went completely ballistic, is about speaking. It's called How to Speak So That People Want to Listen. And it's had tens of millions of views. I think it's the sixth most viewed TED Talk of all time now, which is incredible. Interesting, though, that TED Talk has had at least five times as many views as the one on listening. So I kind of started to create a real understanding there's a problem in the world. Organizations aren't listening. People aren't listening. And this is now creating a really big problem for us in relationships, in businesses, and in society as well. So I wrote a book about speaking and listening called How to Be Heard, which actually was that was a little bit of a deception. Because the TED Talk on speaking had been so successful, I was keying off that really with the title of that book. But half that book's about listening. And then my new book is called Sound Effects, and it is a plea to listen, really, on the basis that sound is extraordinary, wonderful, amazing, incredible, and worth listening to. So it's also a guided tour of the wonders of sound. So that's kind of, that's the journey I've been on, really. Been looking at this and thinking about sound and listening for decades now.
So I've been on this planet 33 years so far, Julian. I don't think I've ever met somebody that said, oh, nice to meet you, I'm a bad listener. I'll admit that. Okay, so I don't think anyone's ever said, hands down, yeah, I'm bad at listening. So if we grabbed a marker pen and we wrote on this table, bad listener, and we did a mind map together, what do you think are going to be some of the symptoms and bits that stand out of bad listening?
Yeah, it's very, very common. And you're right, people don't admit it. We always think we're better listeners than we really are. The first thing would be confusing hearing with listening. Those things get collapsed a lot of the time, and they're different. Hearing is a capability. It's a very important capability. It's our primary warning sense. Still, you know, for 300,000 years, Homo sapiens has been around. And just like with every other species on the planet, listening, hearing is key for danger detection and food detection for two reasons. First, you can hear what's behind you. I'm not very good at seeing what's behind me. I don't know about you guys. And second, even more important, you can hear in the dark. The eyes don't work in either of those two situations, and they're both critical because it's dark half the time. And in many places in the world, in jungles and places like that, it's dark a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So hearing is really important. It goes very deep, very fast, and it's very significant, but it's different from listening. Most people think we listen automatically. That's absolutely wrong. Listening is a skill. It's a skill that you can master. It's a skill that you can pay attention to and develop. It's also work. So you have to know you're doing something when you're listening. And that is very different from the kind of listening that we do. Yeah, I am listening to you. No, you're sending a text. That's different. Partial listening is okay. You know, I'm not saying it's evil or bad to listen partially, but Scott Peck said you cannot listen to another person and do anything else at the same time. Not truly listen. And how often do we do that? So, you know, this is a good little bit of inventory for you. I mean, you both got families. When's the last time you put everything down, did nothing else, and truly listened to a member of your family? It's not something we do all the time. We do a great deal of partial listening while we're doing something else. You know, it's multitasking, busy world, and so forth. So that conflation of hearing and listening and the misunderstanding that listening just happens automatically, that is the root of a lot of bad listening.
It sounded like you were talking, the way you were describing it there sounded like a spectrum. So you've got hearing at the back end, and probably maybe even not hearing, there's probably levels below that. And then there's probably partially listening, and then there's maybe listening to the things that are not being said, and the non-verbal cues and the silences and the gaps and the way things are being said. So how do you view it? If I was, okay, I'm somebody that goes through life, I just hear people, and I want to work my way up the ranks. What does that actually look like to get to the top? What is an amazing listener?
Well, it takes work. And the first thing is to understand that listening is a skill. I mean, once you open that door, you're thrown into a whole new world where you recognize that hearing is one layer. As you say, you can think of it as a spectrum is a good way to think of it. I tend to think of it in layers. Hearing is your base layer, and not to be taken for granted, by the way. I mean, there are roughly 1 in 4 people in the world have got damaged hearing. Mm. So we can't just take for granted that somebody can hear us. And if they've got damaged hearing, that is a really big problem. Many of them don't use hearing aids because there's a pride thing involved in it. And damaged hearing can lead to all sorts of social problems, isolation, loneliness, depression, disconnection from people. Because, you know, it's embarrassing not to be able to, what did you hear the whole time? You know, I'm a long-time drummer. I've lost everything above 12 kilohertz. But fortunately, I can still hear you. But think how depressing and demeaning it is if you're losing your hearing like that and you start not to be able to hear people talking to you all the time. So we can't take that for granted. But that is the base layer. Listening is on top of that. And you can think of it, I suppose, as a pyramid would be another way to represent it, where, you know, most of the time we're partially listening. And that's kind of okay. You know, if you're doing the washing up or the cooking or something and somebody's telling you a joke, that works. But if they're pouring out their heart to you, or they're really upset, or they've got something very complicated to put across, that doesn't work so well. And that's where it goes wrong. Also, there are many listening positions. So attentiveness is one. I mean, I talk about listening scales, if you like. You could have focused listening and distracted listening. That's a scale as well. We talked just before we came on air about gender-based listening. Mm. You know, men listen slightly differently to women, by and large. I mean, it's very hard to generalize about these things. But men tend to listen for a point, to solve a problem. to achieve something, get to a destination. Women tend to be more expansive than that. They tend to be going with the flow, just on a journey with the other person. And that can create the kind of typical complaint in relationships of, you never listen to me, because perhaps we're in the wrong listening position. I talk about listening positions a lot. So there are a lot of different listening positions, critical listening, which is very useful at work, perhaps, where you're assessing, evaluating, taking the bits out that are useful to you and discarding the rest. Perhaps not something to take home to your family, where you might want to be in empathic listening. And that's kind of listening from your heart and being on the other person's island, feeling their feelings and really understanding what's going on for them. One of the biggest things, I think, in the modern world, which is interrupting our listening, is being right. There's a great quote from the American counselor and author Harville Hendricks, who's somebody I admire a great deal. He said, "You can either be right or be in a relationship."
I love that.
And he said, "You can't cuddle up with being right at the end of the day." So I think, you know, there's so much truth in that. And of course, what's the easiest way to be right? Make somebody else wrong. That is so endemic in the world now. You only have to look at the comments underneath a news story, or even worse, a YouTube video, and you really start to understand how this is becoming now an addiction, that people want to make other people wrong. Because if I make you wrong, it makes me right. I'm up, you're down. It makes me feel better. It's an ego-driven thing. And it's becoming, look at politics, the polarization that we're seeing in the world now is frightening. And it's a slippery slope, that, you know, if we're demonizing people, making them wrong, judging, condemning, and you know, losing contact with the understanding they can be different and right in their own world, and that's okay. You know, two people can have very different points of view and both be right, because they're different perspectives, experiences, and so forth. Once we lose that and it becomes a zero-sum game, I'm right, you're wrong, that is the route to conflict. And that's what we're seeing now. We see it in war in the world now. It's happening, you know, it's breaking out in all sorts of places. We see it in politics, where it's a politics of complete polarization, where it becomes impossible for a politician to agree with anything the other side ever think. You know, it's like anathema to them. And indeed, you know, in society, so I mean, this really concerns me. That is the route to what happened in Rwanda, where, you know, you're living next door to somebody one minute and then next minute you're killing them with a machete. I mean, that's the kind of polarization we are heading towards. And I do worry about this, because that's all about not listening. It's all about not listening to somebody, not coming from compassion, understanding, and just discarding people as wrong, bad, and so forth. And we've got to stop this.
I think this leads really nicely into something that you said last time we had you on, and I hope you don't mind, we stole this from you for our team in the business we have. You said we need to think about the listening that we're speaking into.
Oh, yeah.
So for people who are watching this now and have taken in what you've just said, of the listening landscape has changed, how can we be more deliberate about the way we're speaking into that?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. So the key understanding here, as well as that listening is a skill, so that's, it's not hearing, that's one really important and transformative realization. The other really big one is that everybody's listening is unique, and that's the source of this idea that you always speak into a listening, because most people go around thinking everybody listens like I do, and they don't. If you think that, you're basically speaking to yourself the whole time. Which, you know, okay, that you can do that, but it's not very effective, because people don't listen like you do. They listen differently because they've had different experiences and they've got different values, attitudes, beliefs, different cultures, different languages, perhaps, all sorts of things. So that's something I teach very much when I'm teaching about speaking, is this concept of becoming sensitive to the listening you're speaking into, which is different, and it changes over time. You know, your listening and mine changes through the day, changes when we have a coffee or a beer or whatever it might be, changes if we're tired, happy, unhappy, changes based on what just happened to us and what we're thinking about and so forth. So listening is not a constant, and it differs from person to person. That's really important to understand, because when we can understand that, we can start to connect on a different level with people. Speaking into a listening means really focusing on getting the ball over the net to the other person. How is it being received? You know, who are they? It might be, I don't know, you might be speaking to somebody who's very, very slow paced, you know. And if you're speaking like this, you'll just overwhelm them with inappropriate pace because they can't process that fast. We're all different. Mm-hmm. So I think asking that question is only polite. But understanding that, you can flip it back the other way. And that's where this idea of listening positions comes from. Because whilst I can't change your listening, well, I can to a degree by maybe inspiring you or amusing you or engaging with you. But, you know, those are marginal things. Your listening is your listening. I don't have control of that. I have got control of my listening. So not only is listening different from hearing, it's also volitional. I can change my listening position. So I can deliberately move from distract, yeah, what did he say? No, I'll be with you in a minute. You know, that kind of distracted listening. I can move from, oh, hold on a second, put that down. Now, what were you saying? So I can move from one to the other by a deliberate choice. I can move from critical to empathic. I can move from all sorts of different, like a more masculine listening position where I'm trying to solve something to a more feminine listening position where I'm just being with you. Hey, wherever it goes, that's really interesting. And that can be very, very useful in relationships as well.
Interesting. And then how do my biases get in the way of my listening?
Well, they will. And the key thing is to be conscious of what they are. So start to entertain the idea that you've got listening filters and become conscious of what they are. So one of the exercises I do in my training courses and in my book, actually, How to Be Heard is in there, is an audit of your filters. So when you become conscious that I've got these values, I've got these attitudes that I've picked up, I've got these biases or prejudices or whatever it may be, once you're conscious of them, you can either engage them or switch them off and challenge them. Maybe long term, maybe they're not appropriate in your life. Maybe they make you angry or upset all the time, you know, or maybe they're getting in the way of a particular relationship with a particular person. So we're all kind of used to being a bit of a chameleon where, you know, what you would say to your mum perhaps is different from what you'd say to your best mate. Yeah, you might phrase it differently, you might use different language and so forth. You know, when I'm speaking, I often will change not so much the core of what I'm saying, but how I'm putting it across to an audience. If it's an older audience or a different nationality or whatever, I'm conscious of those things, and I will try to make sure I'm using vernacular, delivery, pace, tone, vocabulary, whatever it is that's appropriate to that relationship, whatever it is, if it's 1 to 1,000, 1 to 1. Yeah. So being conscious of your filters is a very, very powerful thing to be in life.
So we do a lot of coaching and work with salespeople who predominantly would do a lot of their selling and prospecting over the phone. So we remove that visual element. So if we take away anything visual, one of the big things that I see is people saying, but how do I show them that I'm listening? And the typical default would be you talking and I'm in the background going, How do we, if we remove that, as I'm guessing that's probably not the way, unless you might surprise me, but how do we show people that we're listening if there's no visual?
Some of that is really good. You know, if you can't see somebody, if you talk about phone calls and not video calls, then you can't see somebody's response. And, you know, one of the tools I have been using for a long time is RASA, which is receive, appreciate, summarize, ask. And the receive bit is paying attention to the person. Now, if you're doing that on the telephone, you're just really paying attention. They can't see you doing that. So the appreciate bit is, it is, but not all the time. And it becomes irritating if somebody's doing that every 3 seconds. So the other way of appreciating is to move to the summarize piece, which is to reflect back to the person. So what I just heard you say is this, did I get you, Jack? Is that what you said? And that means you feel heard. So I'm doing that all the time. And that's a very powerful way of showing that the ball got over the net. I received what you sent, which isn't always the case. we often think we've sent something very clearly. You know, how many times have we all sent an email and somebody's completely misconstrued what we sent? And even in speaking.
True.
So, yes, I think that's a very powerful way to make sure somebody is heard. Interesting, you're talking about, I mean, of course, we're talking about sales, but I saw a fascinating statistic quite recently, which shocked me. The sweet spot for selling in terms of the proportion of time speaking and listening in a call is precisely the reverse of what most salespeople do. The reverse. Most salespeople speak 65% of the time and listen 35%. If you want to close more often, you need to be listening 65%, speaking 35%. That's based on quite a lot of research now. It's a mistake that so many people make. The most important part of a sales conversation is not the speaking. And yet we train salespeople all the time. Here's your script, or here are the answers, here's the objections, here are the answers to the objections. Let's look at your tone, let's, you know, brighten that up. Delivery, delivery, delivery. Well, that's a third of it. Two-thirds of it needs to be listening really well to somebody and leaving the prospect or the client feeling heard, understood, and valued. That's the secret.
That's brilliant. I didn't know that, but I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all. So there's probably a bit of a contradiction. So we would say to our team, you have to be actively listening to the person on the phone, but you also need to be making notes. Very old school. I know Zach's been in trouble in the past in sales jobs where people have said, where's your notepad and pen? Don't come to work without one again. Because if you're saying something in paragraph one and then we're 20 minutes down the road, well, actually, paragraph one is very important now to help with that summary. But then I'm starting to think, but am I passively listening? Am I multitasking? Am I truly listening? What's your take on that? How could people possibly do both?
That's a question I get asked a lot, actually, and not just in sales conversations, but lectures, for example. Can I listen and take notes at the same time? You can. Some people listen better that way. Whether you're taking mind map notes or some people doodle, I'm talking about intentional doodling, not just drawing any old rubbish, but, you know, shapes and words and just icons, really, that enable you to recall the conversation. If you're writing quite, extensive notes, that certainly is taking part of your cognitive bandwidth. But it may be better for you to do that and to be able to refer back to things. Of course, we've all got AI now. So, you know, if you're on a call, the AI can log everything, give you the action points at the end. So if it's a question of memory, you don't have to do that anymore. Otter or some other AI can do it for you. And I'm sure most salespeople use that now. I'd be amazed if they don't. But if it's a question of in the call, being able to refer back to something that was said 10 minutes ago, I think notes-taking is very powerful, and it can actually help you to listen in that way. So it's not a destructive thing. It certainly takes a bit of your cognitive bandwidth, and you have to be careful not to be, you know, spending all your time on the paper and not listening to what the person's saying.
Hope you're listening, salespeople. Take notes. So I'm thinking about Louis Theroux, the documentary filmmaker, when we're talking. He's known for pausing a lot and leaving lots of room. So big open question and leaving lots of room. So could you tell us the power of pausing, giving lots of room, and actually silence and saying nothing?
Well, it's very powerful on stage if you're presenting. I think, you know, one of the exercises I talk about, so let's just backtrack a bit here. Silence is a very important sound. It's really important. Half of humanity live in cities now, and it's going up all the time. So there's a lot of people who don't experience a lot of silence, unless it's, you know, something you create around you. If you're lucky enough to live in a quiet apartment or you've got great soundproofing, a lot of the time noise is around us and we get deadened to the sense of hearing and it makes us listen less well. So reacquainting yourself with silence is a very, very important part of listening well. And it's an exercise I would recommend to anybody. 3 minutes of silence a couple of times a day, very good for you. Being comfortable with silence is another level. I know a lot of people who live in cities who, if they go to the countryside, they go, it's really quiet here. I don't feel comfortable with that. So that is an issue. Because if you're uncomfortable with silence, then if you're on stage and you want a moment to think, you'll start gabbling. People, I've seen, it's the bit, one of the biggest problems I see with speakers on stage is they think they've got to fill every second with their voice. And that tends to create the ums and ahs and you knows and all that stuff. They're just the filler words. But in a sales conversation, it's 10 times more important to be comfortable with silence. Because the biggest crime you can commit in a sales conversation is to close or open. I mean, I would tend to think of it as opening, not closing. I think that word is very pejorative, actually. An open is, where are we going next? Mm. So, you know, how should we move on? What should we do about this? There's an opening to action. When you do an open, let's call it an open, you want to stop and say nothing. And the biggest crime after 10 seconds of silence where the client hasn't said anything is to come back in, because you just lost it completely. If you can be a really powerful friend of silence and be comfortable with silence for 30 seconds in a call, the client is going to, it's like a staring game, you know, like chicken. You have to be strong. If you're strong enough to sit there in silence, the client will eventually ask a question, which is normally something like, well, so how much does that cost? Or, you know, how do I do this? Or how do I, it'll be a buying sign of some kind. Or it'll be the objection they're holding on to that you haven't been able to tease out yet. Yeah. So that silence is your best friend in a sales conversation. And not be able to do it, that's going to lose so many sales.
Amazing. You touched then on emotional state, so silence actually being able to alter emotional state. And I was listening to comedian Bill Burr the other day talking about how his wife's got him listening to lo-fi and shoegaze music because he gets angry sometimes, and having that on calms him down. Mm. So are you able to talk about how we can use sound to literally alter emotional state?
Yeah, and it's different for everybody. Whether, because sound affects us in four ways. So this is very much, you know, in the beginning of the new book, I talk about, you know, what is sound and the relationship with vibration, which is very important as well. And then how does it affect us? And, you know, that's something that most people are unconscious about. Sound changes our bodies. So heart rate, breathing, hormone secretion, brain waves, all of these things are changed by the sound around us. Whether it's a sudden noise that sets off a fight-flight reflex, which is primal. There's nothing we can do about that. 300,000 years, or 3 million years of evolution before that, you know, sudden noise, watch out. Your brain, right down the, you know, the very, very lowest part of your lizard brain will take that sound and immediately flood you with cortisol, noradrenaline, you know. There's nothing you can do to stop that. By the time your cortex has gone, oh, that's okay, that was a car backfiring, way too late. We process sound 20 times faster than sight. Wow. For that reason. And, you know, it goes very deep, very fast. Sound, second way sound affects us is emotionally. And music is probably one of the most obvious ways of understanding that. So there's a song, you know, that'll make you happy. There's a song that'll make you sad. And loads of things in between. Music is emotion in sound very often, which is why I have a problem with AI music, but let's not get into that. If we become conscious of these effects, we can start to use them consciously. The third way is cognitive. So a lot of salespeople work in quite noisy places, for example, and even worse, you know, call centers, where there may be selling going on in call centers. Some of them are just customer service places where it's dealing with complaint after complaint after complaint in a room that's probably 90 decibels, sitting right next to people who are having noisy conversations. Not surprising, the staff turnover in those places can be as high as 80% a year.
Yeah, wow.
What a job. I mean, just a nightmare, dealing with constant complaints all day and shouting and being surrounded by noise. The stress is unbelievable. No wonder people burn out. So, you know, if you're running a sales team, okay, I can understand high energy. You want to have a buzz and all that kind of thing. But you do not want to put people into a situation where they're exposed to noise all day, because that is stress-inducing and fatigue-inducing, and you'll burn people out. So they also won't be able to think. because we've got bandwidth for 1.6 human conversations, which means if you're trying to listen to a client and you can hear the person next door talking to their client, you're really struggling because that's taking up one of your 1.6 and you're really not able to pay attention here or listen to the voice in your head, which may be, you know, interpreting or deciding what you're going to say next. Although that's not true listening, but, you know, we have to do it a fair bit of the time. I call it speech writing, you know, when you're actually thinking about what you're going to say next while this noise is going on in front of you, which is the other person talking. And the fourth way sound affects us is it changes our behavior. So we know, for example, noisy offices make people less helpful and sociable, more angry, more irritable. So there's a lot of behavioral aspects. I mean, noise tends to be associated with aggression. War is quite noisy. You know, if a bunch of people are attacking a bunch of people, there tends to be a lot of shouting and noise going on. So there's an association, really, of noise with aggression, which is very primal again, and which is something that is hard to break. So we want to be careful about the environments we're putting people in and how they're affecting them. So that's the first thing. If you're managing an environment, you can actually become conscious about what you're doing to people, what you're doing to their bodies, their feelings, their thinking, and their behavior with the sound you make in that space. And then us as individuals, as soon as you become conscious of all this stuff going on, you can start to say, all right, is this the best sound for me? So I talk about savoring is another great exercise from my books and my trainings and so forth. Savoring is simply close your eyes wherever you are and ask yourself three questions. Is this sound healthy? Is it actually healthy for me? Is it helpful? Is it, you know, underwriting what I'm trying to do? Is it supporting me in selling or talking or whatever it might be, reading, whatever you're trying to do in a space? And is it making me happy? Is it actually a sound that I enjoy? And it's amazing how often in our houses or offices, if you ask those three questions, you'll get at least one no, if not two or three. Simply by closing your eyes and becoming conscious, you can start to change it.
When you were talking there, Julian, you made me, I was thinking about the cocktail party effect where you can be in a conversation with somebody and then next thing you know, you hear your name and I think, were you truly in that conversation? So you laid it out quite nicely there. It felt like that was the problem. Obviously, it's 2025. Things are getting noisier, louder, and busier. What are the do's and don'ts then? If you were to present the solution to people, those questions that they can ask themselves is great, but how would you recommend that people do live their life in order to be happier, healthy when it comes to the way sound affects them?
Consciously. So this is the whole secret. Actually, everything I do is part of a bigger conversation about being a conscious human being. I mean, we go through a lot of our lives, a lot of the time, unfortunately, in a very kind of unconscious, zombie-like state. And social media has made that 50 times worse. I mean, I read things from America about the education system in America and about the zombie culture there of everybody coming into lectures and school with phones and just doom-scrolling through the whole thing. And spending far more attention on Facebook or whatever it is, you know, TikTok or whatever, than what the teacher is talking about. And it's becoming such a disconnect now that, I mean, there are books about this. There's Sherry Turkle's book, Alone Together. That's a great book about this whole disconnect of, you know, the idea of people sitting around a meal table, a family sitting around a meal table, and everybody's looking at their hand. And nobody's actually with the people who are there with. They're with somebody a long way away. So replacing a few deep relationships with a lot of very shallow ones. So this whole influence on us, I think, is taking us away from consciousness. It's creating this kind of unconscious way of being, which is distracted, always distracted. And then it becomes addictive. And we start to seek distraction because, you know, the feeling of sitting with ourselves or intimately sitting with another human being and talking and listening becomes uncomfortable. It's not something we're used to. And there's quite a lot of research now showing that, you know, Gen Z and younger are not comfortable with face-to-face conversations, mm-hmm. with speaking and listening so much. They'd much rather be texting people than speaking to them. And that, to me, is an issue, because there's a lot of people in the world who are now in danger of losing their jobs to AI, which is going to disintermediate. There's a lot of jobs that the AI can do the grunt work. And that means if you're going to be in selling, for example, now I'm not suggesting that there's going to be AI sales bots out there doing most of the selling, but the grunt work underlying it, you know, the customer service parts, maybe the kind of administrative bits, the checking ins, all this kind of thing. Yes, there'll be a lot of that that can be done. So if you're going to rise above that and use AI to enhance your own brilliance, that is down to relationship. Why would somebody want to work with you or deal with you? It's because they like you. It's because you understand them. Because every time they call you, they get a solution that really works for them. Because you haven't tried to sell them stuff that doesn't work for them. Because you're not high-pressuring them. Because you're not annoying and not listening and all those things. So that the heart of the thing is developing a trust-based relationship, which is about speaking and listening. And that's not something I think AIs will be able to do for quite a long time. Mm. I mean, they can respond, and they'll be doing that in sound very, very shortly. I mean, that's coming, like, it may be months away, if not it not many years away, where we'll be speaking to AI and listening to AI, and it'll sound like, you know, Jarvis in an Iron Man. It'll be, you know, a normal conversation, but it won't have a heart, and it won't really understand us and how we feel. Because AIs don't have feelings. They can be clever at emulating that, but they can't replace that human connection. That's the thing that makes us uniquely human. And that's the thing which I think is at the heart of a great sales relationship, is that connection with somebody. Or a great, you know, if you're talking to an audience, it's making that connection on a heart level, on a soul level with people. So this is all about becoming conscious of what we're doing and differentiating ourselves from machines and not getting sucked into this kind of unconscious zombie state of intensity and distraction the whole time.
So it sounds like we might be heading for a listening epidemic. What have you thought much about what the future would look like if we don't solve this now?
Yes, and it is very frightening, I think. Very frightening. Conflict and disconnection. And, you know, a lot of other things, eco-side, apart from anything else, the damage we're doing to the environment with our noise is terrifying. I mean, I'll give you a couple of examples. Whales, for example, can communicate. I mean, a lot of my book is about the incredible sounds of nature and the planet and even the cosmos. Whales, blue whales, for example, can communicate or could communicate across more than 1,500 kilometers range in the ocean. The very low frequency sound penetrates, sound travels six times faster in water than it does in air, and far further as well. And so they can send sound thousands of kilometers from one whale to another whale. And they're very solitary creatures. That's how they found each other. They find each other. It's how they mate. It's how they communicate. We have 60,000 ships at any one time on the oceans producing a lot of noise with their propellers. Mm-hmm. So we've created an auditory fog. We've deafened the whales. Their range is now 10% of what it was before we were doing this. So they've only got a range now to 150 kilometers or so at most. And they're not able to find each other and talk to each other in the same way. This has a devastating effect on their breeding and social behavior. That's just one example of the way in which we are affecting the natural environment with the noise that we're creating. Cities are, you know, deafening places. And so there's not a great deal of wildlife in cities because they can't communicate and their natural habitat, of course, doesn't exist here. So the way we're spreading cities out and building more and more cities, there are a lot of people losing connection with the sounds of nature, which we evolved to, we're designed for, wind, water, and birds. I was shocked to read the other day that America has lost one-third of its birds over the last 30 years. And the number is declining really rapidly as we use pesticides to kill, or insecticides rather, to kill insects, which we consider to be a pest for our crops. That's what the birds eat. So their food's gone, and we're devastating their habitats as well. by destroying them. So a third of the birds have gone. It may well be our children will never wake up and hear the dawn chorus. Now that to me is frightening. You know, we are having a devastating effect on this planet with our noise. So again, you know, the consciousness of this is very, very important. Unfortunately, noise is not a political issue. You won't get many politicians saying, vote for me, I'll make it quieter. It's not going to happen, unfortunately. So, you know, this is really my life's work, is to sensitize people. Because if we start listening, all of this reverses. We rebuild our relationships with one another, in our families, in our teams at work, in organizations, and in politics. You know, why can't we have a politics of consensus where people can actually say, you know what, the opposition has a very good point there. I think we'll take that one on board. Wouldn't it be rather nice if that could happen instead of this kind of finger-pointing and demonizing that we have? So in every way, you know, we can reconnect, and not only with each other, but with nature, which is such a disconnect and so bad for us to lose that connection with what we've evolved in and to be damaging it to the degree we are. It's all about listening.
Is there any truth to, I'm just thinking of kind of adding some benefit around some of the stuff that you just said that people can maybe take away and try straight away. Is there anything around, if I can hear a fire crackling and water running, I digest food better? Or if I can hear my child's heartbeat, or, you know, those things that you can actually invite into situations in your life to make them more deliberate or enjoyable, or, like I say, digest food better, and anything like that, that's kind of things people can be introducing?
Yes, because if you become conscious of sound and you do that, the savouring exercise I was talking about earlier, and ask yourself, is it, you know, happy, healthy and helpful? Then you can start to design sound that's going to make you feel better. Yeah, probably digestion. I mean, we don't digest very well if we're stressed, and noise stresses us. So eating in very noisy restaurants, for example, not only do you go home with a sore throat and a sore head, but you're stressed and tired, and you probably haven't digested the food that well. Also, by the way, you can't taste it so well, because if you overload one sense, it tends to suppress the others, called cross-modal effects. So there's now research showing this. If a restaurant is very noisy, we don't taste sugar and salt as well as we would in a quieter space. So yeah, all sorts of things. I mean, for example, if you have problems sleeping, you could use gentle surf. It's a really good sound to use. A lot of people now are using what everybody calls white noise. It's not white noise, it's actually pink noise. White noise is a very high-pitched hiss, not very nice. Pink noise is the one that most people use. It's more like that kind of sound. Mm. Well, if it works for you, fine, because I'm not judgmental and we're all different. But I'm not a big fan personally of artificial noise. It would be much better, I think, to use a natural analog to that, which might be gentle surf. Very similar frequencies, does the same sort of thing. It's also got a cadence which is very similar to the breathing of a sleeping human being. And it's associated with being on a beach, not a problem in the world, on holiday, lovely, happy, you know, relaxed. So there's a lot of associations there with that sound. And we haven't got any associations with brown noise or pink noise. It's just noise. And it's artificial. And I think there is now research showing that that kind of masking sound in offices creates stress in people. So that can be helpful if you're having trouble sleeping. If you want to wake up in the morning, birdsong. If you want to work, birdsong. Birdsong's fantastic. We've evolved. I mean, the birds have been here a lot longer than we have, millions of years. And so we have evolved to listen to it. And, you know, it's why it's so depressing that it's disappearing. You can record birdsong. It's nature's alarm clock. It's time to be awake when the birds are singing. We know that. So if you have an alarm clock that's birdsong, it will wake you up. And it's also a sound that makes most people feel secure. Because we've learned over hundreds of thousands of years again that when the birds are happily singing, things are normally okay. It's only if they all fall silent you need to start worrying. Mm-hmm. You know, tsunami coming, or a lion, or something mm-hmm. that you need to pay attention to. So there's a couple of sounds which are kind of, I think, universally quite helpful for most people. Gentle surf to go to sleep, birdsong to wake up, birdsong if you want to mask in an office, headphones with birdsong, brilliant. Because music is replacing one distraction with another. If it, you know, if you're taking away the irritating conversation that you don't want to listen to and replacing it with music, which is much more pleasant, but it still is a distraction because music generally is made to be listened to and it is distracting.
Have you noticed anything in your own journey that has changed? So an opinion you maybe had when you started your journey that's completely different now as you've explored this further?
I think I've understood far more that it is very difficult to generalize. I was probably more judgmental about people who make noise, you know, sodcasting, which is the word for, you know, the hoodies on the bus with their phones playing loud, whatever it is, and disturbing the grannies, you know. Well, everybody's got their own, I mean, there's reasons for that. You know, it's a kind of tribal, territorial thing, and there's work that's been done around this. And so I think I'm probably more compassionate now about a lot of things. You know, if I don't like that, I can go and sit downstairs, can't I? And I can take responsibility for the sound I'm consuming without being judgmental, as long as I can move. You know, if I'm stuck, then I think I have a right to try and do something about it, unless I'm scared of getting attacked. Nowadays, I'll just sit and grin and bear it, you know. But yeah, I think compassion is very important, and understanding that everybody's different and that everybody's got their own different ways of relating to sound. And, you know, there's probably somebody on this planet who can work really, really effectively with very loud death metal music. And that's not me. I couldn't do that. I like silence when I'm working. But being conscious of what you do and don't like and what works for you is half the battle. And allowing other people to have their consciousness is the other half of the battle, not making everybody like you, because they're not. So I think, yeah, compassion has been the biggest change.
You listening to him, Zach? You can't be playing your death metal in the office anymore.
I know, I'm sorry.
We don't want to hear it. I want to ask a bit of a selfish question now, Julian. I'd like to ask some advice. We've got young children, and we are trying to raise them to be amazing young human beings. How do we effectively raise our children to be incredible listeners?
Listen to them, Jack. That's the biggest secret of all. And actually, you know, I've got a three-year-old as well. And I've developed, you know, I've got a very strong relationship with Sapphire. And a lot of that is about a commitment I've made, really, from birth to have eye-to-eye contact with her. So, you know, if you're three, you're down there, and you're looking up at this towering, enormous, giant person who's talking down to you, that's not a great conversation. So if I'm talking to Sapphire, I'll pick her up and put her on my knee and we'll be eye to eye. Or I'll go down to her level and really squat down onto the floor. So if you can do eye to eye with children, it is so powerful, because you're then saying, you're important and I'm listening to you because I love you and you're really important to me. And the confidence that engenders in a child is fantastic. Whereas if they're always being ignored or, you know, talked down to, and you're always busy and doing something else, you know, if their experience is, yeah, what, you know, that's not a great way to raise children to become listeners.
Mm.
So listen to them and have eye contact on a level. I think those are two great ways to teach children how to be confident and how to listen to other people.
I love that. We're a long way away from children should be seen and not heard, which is
nightmare thing, yes.
Which is good. I would like to talk about your book and the community. Tell us, obviously, this whole conversation was around the book. So what problems could people be facing in their world? Why should they go and buy your book?
Well, the book is a plea to listen in a world which is forgetting how to do that. So I think the book is a tour of the wonders of sound. So it is fascinating from that point of view. You know, the thing I said about blue whales is a tiny, tiny, literally drop in the ocean of the amazing things that are in that book. Mm. So it's full of, you know, jaw-dropping wonders. And that's a great reason to listen, is the wonder of sound. So it's got the sound of the planet, the sound of animals, the sound of us, which is largely not great, and the sound of the cosmos. People think space is silent. It's not. Actually, there's a lot of sound in space, right up to and including the most spooky sound I've ever heard, which is the sound of the black hole at the center of the Perseus galaxy cluster, which makes sound. It's vibrating the gas cloud in that galaxy cluster with real sound waves.
Mm.
They're way too low for us to hear, so they have to pitch shift it up 57 octaves for us to hear it. But when you do, oh my goodness, you have to buy the book. And the book's got a website with, there are numbers in the book for all the sounds that I talk about, and then you can go to the website and hear them as you're reading it. So that's a really nice way to interact with the book, and you can listen to that sound of the black hole. It is so spooky. So that's a big chunk of the book, and it ends with a chapter on silence as well, and things like Shinrin Yoku, forest bathing, how you can get silence in the world and where to find it. And then the front end of the book is about sound, what it is, how it affects us, and how we can listen better. So it's kind of a manual, if you like. It's very practical. It's got lots of exercises in it. But it's also a tour of everything I found to be extraordinary and amazing and wonderful that makes it worth listening in the world.
Beautiful, beautiful. And the community. Tell us about the community.
Yes, well, I wanted to take it on from, you know, the book is fantastic. It's taken me 2 years, and I'm really excited it's out there in the world. Just actually, as we record this, launching next month in America, but out now in the UK. And then it's coming out in German, Italian, Japanese, and Mandarin.
Wow.
In the coming months as well. So hopefully it's going to make a difference. Then on top of that, I wanted to do something where I could interact with people.
Mm-hmm.
And bring people together who are interested in listening better. Whether that's parenting, you know, you talked about that, and I think listening for parents is a huge subject. And you know, teaching children to listen. Salespeople, customer service people, leaders, managers, business, absolutely, professionals. I mean, for example, do you know the average time that you get to describe your symptoms to an American doctor before they interrupt you? 18 seconds.
Wow.
So the listening there perhaps could be improved, you know, before they interrupt you. And that's an average. Some are doing it faster than that. So a lot of the professions, you know, doctors listening, I mean, I know they've done work on this, but the listening of doctors, the empathy, when you're describing something that's deeply frightening and disturbing to you, or they're telling you something that's deeply frightening and disturbing, that's, you know, it's important. So professions, absolutely. And family members generally. So all sorts of levels, listening is so, so, so important. And I wanted to create a community where people can come together, have access to amazing resources. And I've busily been putting stuff into this. It's based on the Circle platform. So I don't know if you've come across Circle. It's a very good global platform for building communities.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows me to put in video, audio, documents and things. And I've been doing lots of that. So there's like 38 podcasts, hour-long podcasts in there, every one I've ever done with all sorts of interesting people. My whole big training course is in there, How to Speak So That People Want to Listen, which is available on the internet for £299. It's in the community. So, and I'm putting in everything I can think of in there, trainings, documents, research, everything. But the most important part of it will be people coming together, people sharing the problems, other people, not me, giving them solutions and advice and wisdom and so forth. So, you know, we were talking earlier, I've met some amazing people in this journey I've had the last 20 years from TED and from the work I've done. And I'm asking some extraordinary people into the community. So it will be full of amazing people. So it's a living, breathing, dynamic thing. And I want it to be, you know, a focus, a nexus that really does have an influence and starts to generate listening in the world for years to come. So this is my life's work now.
Beautiful. The mission that you're on, we love it. And obviously we've had you on the podcast before. We've invited you back because you're one of our favorites. So Julian, thank you. Thank you so, so much for making the effort. And thank you for joining us today. An incredible conversation.
So good. Thank you very much for having me.